back to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm your host, Jason Berlindi from the Fretboard Journal print magazine. Every Friday on this show, I try to talk to somebody doing something interesting in the world of fretted instruments. Sometimes it's a builder, sometimes it's a player. Today, I'm talking to a young mandolin player named Simon Gunson, who has absolutely blown me away with his debut album, Chicken Bridge, which came out about a year ago. Simon and I have been playing email tag. We finally got to have a conversation just a few hours ago, and I'm really happy to share the interview that I did with you all. Simon is a mandolin player working largely outside of the bluegrass realm. Chicken Bridge is this sort of free jazz record that if you love Julian Lage or you love Bill Frisell, I think you will get into. The opening track, Sydney, really stopped me in my tracks. You can go find that on YouTube or Spotify. Listen to that before you listen to this interview. It might give you a little insight as to why I love this guy's music so much. He's playing a mandolin with a humbucking pickup on it through a pedal board. You kind of forget what you're listening to because his compositions are so strong, and I really just wanted to hear more about it. Simon is down in North Carolina, Chapel Hill area. And I had a blast learning about him and his upbringing and how he incorporates the mandolin into his music. And he's just got an interesting perspective on things. I think you're going to really enjoy it, whether or not you are a mandolin player. Before we get to this interview, I got to give a shout out to our sponsors and pay the bills. Carlton Cases down in Austin, Texas is sponsoring the Fretboard Journal podcast. I love my Carlton case. I think you will too. If you have a guitar, a mandolin, or an octave mandolin, or a mandocello, or a banjo, or a fiddle, or a pedal board, they have you covered with a flight case. If you go to their website, you'll see all sorts of crazy things they've done to test their cases, and they stand by their product like few others do. Go to Carlton-Cases.com. We are also brought to you by our friends at Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in New York City, one of the great vintage instrument stores in the world. Right now, a 1940s Vega Profundo Dreadnought. This is a Dreadnought guitar from Vega, ladder braced, one of the coolest headstocks I've ever seen on an acoustic guitar. It's available right now. They also have a 1970 Buck Owens Harmony. Yes, the red, white, and blue one, and so many other cool guitars. Somebody must have just sold a bunch of stuff to them or traded, because there's a Vivitone right now. There's a Gibson K1 Mandocello from 1916 in their brand new arrivals page. Go to retrofret.com. Tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you. We're also brought to you by our friends at Peghead Nation. Today, we're talking about mandolins. We talk about Joe K. Walsh. Joe K. Walsh is one of Peghead Nation's marquee instructors, as is John Reichman and Sharon Gilchrist. I mean, you really can't go wrong if you want to learn mandolin at Peghead Nation or any other stringed instrument in the Americana, bluegrass, roots music realm. They've got you covered. Go to PegheadNation.com. And if you go there, you may as well plug in Fretboard when you check out, because you're going to get your first month free or $20 off of any annual subscription just by being a listener to the Fretboard Journal podcast. Last but not least, our friends at Isotope have you covered. Use the discount code FRET10 and you will have their audio plugins, which will save your butt when you have glitches, noises you want to remove, or if you just want to polish your recordings up a notch. Go to the show notes. I'll include a link to the Isotope page where you can read up on all of their products. I'm going to give one more plug to a podcast that I do that I know many of you already tune into, but the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast. We just put out our 102nd episode. We had a special guest, Brian Sowers of Sour Sound Transformers down in Portland, Oregon. Many of our diehard listeners are saying this is the best Truth About Vintage Amps episode we've ever done. It's really in the weeds. If you have ever looked at the back of your tube amp and wondered what those two little transformer boxes do, go over to that episode, tune in. It goes deep, folks. It goes really, really deep. A lot of it went right over my head. But again, a ton of information to be found on that show. We've inspired so many people to take up soldering. It's kind of insane. 102 episodes, like I said, and they all tend to be pretty fun and quirky and definitely informative. So go check that podcast out if you haven't yet. Fretboard Journal's 51st issue is the one on deck, about to be mailing to everybody. So if you go to fretboardjournal.com and click on that subscribe button, that's the issue you're going to get in just a few weeks. It's a good one. I know a bunch of you are excited about it. And it makes a great gift, I might as well add, because a lot of us are starting to think about the holidays, which are coming up way too fast. Those are my announcements. Again, I'm talking to Simon Dunson today, a young mandolin player who just put out a record called Chicken Bridge, which I think is going to blow a lot of you away. Deep Frizzell influence, as we talk about. It's on Spotify and everywhere else you listen to stuff. And check out that opening track, Sydney. It's pretty darn cool. Well, Simon, thanks for joining us. I have been listening to this record you put out a little while ago, Chicken Bridge. It blew my mind. I want to hear all about that. I also just want to hear about, you know, when the mandolin entered your life, where you grew up, and all that good stuff. So let's start with that. Where are you from, and where are you now?
That's a great question. Well, I grew up just like 10 minutes from where I am right now, actually, which is Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And I graduated college about a year ago. And so I was up in Boston for a couple of years, and I wanted to, I don't know, maybe I wanted to get out of the city for a bit, you know. And it's a good area around here. There's a lot of great musicians. So.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've seen that city grow like crazy since you were a kid.
Yeah, it's crazy. There's tons of development. It'll be a different place in 10 years.
And was the mandolin your first instrument?
It was. Yeah. I think it was all music. Like, was always maybe like kind of like a magnet. I know you like play a show and occasionally you like see a kid who's just like will like stare and watch the whole show, you know. I feel like that was, I was just really drawn to it. And I owned the guitar for a while. I was a really proud owner of one, but I didn't ever actually learn anything that was, you know, chords or anything. And when I was like 9, I think I learned what a mandolin was and managed to get my hands on one and find someone to take lessons with. And I kind of went deep down the rabbit hole since then.
Most people who discover the mandolin, it's through bluegrass. Were your folks really into bluegrass, or did you just kind of stumble upon it?
My folks weren't, but my grandparents lived in Galax.
Okay.
And there's a ton of, you know, old time kind of bluegrass and mountain music and stuff. And I actually remember we went to the Rex Theater. We would do that sometimes. And we saw whatever band, I wish I could remember. And there was a mandolin. And I think because it was small, you know, and you're a kid, and that seemed, because I owned a guitar, you know, and the guitar is huge. You know,
sure.
So I really think it was the size that was like what drew me to it. It seemed like something I could, maybe learn to play a little bit.
Yeah. So you're taking lessons, you're a teenager. Is it mostly, are you trying to do non-bluegrass things out of the gate, or was it bluegrass, all bluegrass for a while?
I originally took from a teacher who was not a bluegrass person. And then I bought a book about Bill Monroe, which is, it's kind of funny to think that I bought a book on like how to play Bill Monroe, because I feel like he's almost the opposite of like, here's a, you know, like learn from a book. But, and then from that, my teacher did something really cool actually. And he said to me, he's like, I don't really know anything about bluegrass, but you know, here's a guy who does, Charles Petty, who is an incredible, incredible teacher. And so through him, I kind of went down the whole Monroe, learning about doing downstrokes and learning about, you know, I guess just the whole bluegrass lineage and tradition and, the right and wrong ways to do things, stuff like that. but then when I, got into high school, I ended up going to Interlochen for the, they have this big like camp, like music camp, you know, and high school, like boarding school. And so I ended up doing that, doing like I got in through like the classical guitar department, and I sort of like mostly just played mandolin, but sometimes would fumble my way through very simple guitar parts when needed in ensemble or whatever.
Was this a surprise to them? Did you apply as strictly just a classical guitarist, or?
I don't know if I think my parents talked to the guitar teacher or reached out, and they were open to like the idea of me coming. So it was kind of maybe a bit ambiguous. I thought I had a lot of freedom, you know, but eventually it felt like a little force with me playing mandolin with like a guitar ensemble. Like, so I was like, I can read, you know, I know guitar a little bit and can read, you know, music on guitar some. So it seemed like for the sake of the group, it would be best if I played guitar sometimes.
Got it. So you go into that, and then you mentioned Boston. So where was the school, or was it Berkeley, or where were you going?
I went to New England Conservatory.
Okay.
So I was very close to Berkeley, and I did a decent chunk of things at Berkeley since it's just down the street. And for anybody that doesn't know, there's a ton of, like, you know, there's usually at least like a dozen mandolin, dozen people getting like a degree in mandolin at Berkeley at a given time. So I would pop over and we could hang out and play. And Joe Walsh is the teacher at Berkeley, which he's such a great, really nice guy and a great mandolin player. So, I guess at Interlochen, I kind of was just so excited about just music in general. And I think that's maybe how I think of myself or what I like is I happen to play mandolin and end up taking lessons and kind of getting deep into it. But I don't really feel like the mandolin is like super significant in itself. I feel like it's more of like a means rather than an end, you know, like I could, in a different, you know, situation, I could play guitar or play piano. And I think it just, I happen to get deep down the whole mandolin road, and that is the easiest way for me to, I don't know, make music.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because it's to view it as just a tool, not a lifestyle, I guess.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I geek out about, you know, there's a couple guys around here with some nice lores, you know, I love playing fancy mandolins as much as anyone, but fundamentally I don't believe like my true calling or something in life is I have to play mandolin. I think if I played something else, it would be the same feeling, you know, the same maybe fulfillment or whatever you want to call it. But so when I was at Interlochen, I did a lot of classical music stuff. And then they also had all my friends were like really into jazz. So then I kind of didn't get it, but I thought I'd, you know, give it a shot since all my friends were into it. And eventually jazz can seem a little, you know, like ambiguous, I think, at first. When you just get into it, like kind of like what is going on? What's the point? But eventually I figured out, and it was listening to Soul Station, this Hank Mobley album. I kind of figured out like, okay, that's the melody. These are the solos. We're in the melody out, you know, like the structure, the form. And then it was like, okay, if these are the solos, you know, like what's going on? What's this language? Because I was mostly coming from a bluegrass background, and you know, there's all sorts of the language in bluegrass is like mostly diatonic, for example, and somewhat maybe like limited in scope often, especially, you know, when you're just learning, you know. So this kind of really blew my mind that somebody could, you know, improvise in this totally different way. And of course, it's still Western music with 12 notes and stuff like that. So in theory, you know, I have all the ingredients to do the same thing, you know. So I think that kind of got me super excited. And I kind of wanted to just figure out like what was going on. Why, how do you, you know, make all the different sounds and play this? Yeah, just totally different music.
Was it pretty instant from hearing that Hank Mobley record that you picked up your mandolin and tried to emulate a little of that? Or did that take time?
I think tried to emulate would be a great way to put it. I ended up taking, you know, like taking lessons with a guy, and I was at a music kind of like arts boarding school. So there actually was a class on like jazz language. And so we would do a lot of kind of like exercises, like cut and dry, kind of like, here's a 2-5-1, you know, and then do it in this key and do it in this key and do it in this key. And I think doing that really kind of, and then I did that. And then I, you know, somewhere I have a notebook with like all the solos on Soul Station written out and stuff like that. Like through a ton of time, I think I've made progress, but I don't think there was ever like one day where I feel like, oh, this is it, I'm doing it. I think the big thing for me is after maybe 4 or 5 years of like just transcribing solo, you know, learning how to play different solos and trying to like learn and listen to and just consume as much music as I could. I kind of was at a point where I was trying to think, like, rather than learning what Grant Green played on this or whoever played on this, you know, like, what do I like, you know, what is meaningful to me, or what music is my favorite, irregardless of genre, irregardless of kind of whatever social or traditional, you know, all these different factors that influence you. And then on top of that, like, what can I do to highlight my strengths? I think some people can really grab you instantly, you know, like a Thiele or something, where they have this crazy virtuosic, you know what I mean? And I think there's a lot of people where, especially with Instagram and with all these kind of like, we live in this, such a fast paced environment now, I feel like. And so I don't think that is maybe the best way for me. I don't think I'm the person that's going to like grab someone in a tenth of a second, you know? So I was like, how can I write a bunch of music and try to develop something that highlights what I'm good at and what I like and what I want to play, you know? Because I don't think bluegrass or jazz or whatever these labels are like, I don't think that's really what I'm attracted to. You know, I think I want to listen to something and, you know, do I like it? Do I not like it? You know, and can I find people that share similar values and want to make similar musical choices? You know, that's what I feel like I really want and get excited about.
Mm-hmm. Are there musicians, I won't even bring up genres, but are there musicians out there that you look to as sort of a template for where you want your career to go?
Oh man. There's so many people. I love so many people. But like Bill Frisell is probably a huge influence of mine. And, you know, I guess maybe a big fan of Bill Frisell's. And I don't know. I think in a lot of ways, Thiele too. I like a lot of what Thiele has done. And what I like the most about him is that he, and this is the case with a lot of people, like Quincy Jones is another person I think of, where you start somewhere and then you're able to turn, like Chris Thiele started out playing with Nickel Creek, which is kind of like folk pop or something like that. And then somehow then he is buddies with Yo-Yo Ma, you know what I mean? And he releases the Bach album, and he does all these like things that I think are really cool and interesting. But I just like that he took something that he already had, and he was able to, like, you know, through one way or another, get to doing all these different crazy, you know, just creative things. Same with, you know, Quincy Jones started out playing trumpet in a big band, and then he has produced Thriller, you know, like, how do you go from that to, you know, that's, yeah, I think it's really interesting. But I don't know. I just want to play music more and mm-hmm. have more going on and write more music, rehearse music, learn.
Yeah.
Learn people's stuff. Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, you're viewing the mandolin more as a, you know, a means to get to where you want to go, and not thinking specifically as maybe a mandolin player. But I'm just curious, are there sounds in your head? Are there things you'd like to do where doing it on the mandolin is just really hard because the range is kind of limited and the output of the sound is sort of mandolin-y?
Yes. That is a constant. Yeah, totally. I, for example, comping, like playing chords, is something I get really worried about, is like my, you know, the range where I'm at the register, like I'm often like above someone else. And so like, how can I play accompaniment and have it seem like I am, you know, supporting them? And even though like the range is higher, how can I guess be in the background while they're in the foreground, even though, you know, kind of higher pitched things are going to jump out even more. So I think in a lot of ways, the limitations are kind of like the game, you know, that's kind of like what makes it fun. Stravinsky's Box or whatever. So I do think there is lots of things where the mandolin limits it, but you know, a lot of people, especially if you're trying to electrify the mandolin or do non-traditional things on the mandolin, the first thing they do is they get rid of four of the strings. For some reason, that became something that people were like, well, the first thing we would do is change it so it's a different instrument and doesn't sound like a mandolin. You know, that for me, that felt weird, you know, because if you have a four string, and for those who don't know, you know, electric mandolin or electrifying mandolin, often they only have four strings.
Yeah.
Or maybe
five. I mean, since Fender and Paul Bigsby, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But to me, if you just played like a clip of that, you know, it doesn't sound like a mandolin. While if you play an eight string mandolin, you know, and you have no clue what's going on, it sounds just like a mandolin, just electrified. Mm-hmm. So for me, I think I am, and this is of course only an opinion, not a right or wrong thing, but I think eight strings to me makes it easier, more easily identifiable.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't going to bring this up till later, but we may as well talk about gear right now, because you did this record, Chicken Bridge, that's like got all sorts of sounds, and there's clearly a pedal board involved, something not often heard in the world of mandolins. What are you using? Or I'm sure you have several mandolins, but what are the primary instruments that you're turning to right now?
Yeah, I pretty much just play one mandolin, and it's on the album, it's all one mandolin except for the intro on Sydney. I took another mandolin with the same setup, which we can talk about. And I put the strings in like the courses, the pairs of strings in octaves. So every one I either put an octave up or an octave down. And then the whole album's live too. So there's no cutting anything up. So I like played the intro and looped it, and then set it down and grabbed the other one. But I play a Girard mandolin, and they're made in Rhode Island by Max, and then Lori, his wife, does the finish work. And I got one when I was maybe 13 or 14. And then I, you know, by the time I was 20 or something, I still really liked that mandolin, which I think was mostly luck in a lot of ways, because I ended up getting a really nice mandolin for a very affordable price. And I'm glad they're a little more expensive now, because so much work goes into these, you know, like these luthiers aren't making money, like, other than the select few that get hot, you know, get the big bucks. Nobody's making that much money off of them. But so
that's rare that the instrument you choose, it doesn't have to be mandolin, it could be guitar, anything. The instrument you picked out at the age of 13, you're now carrying with you as a professional.
Yeah, I still, well, and I actually got one built with the electronic stuff.
Okay. I wanted to ask what's going on there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did the same conversion on a cheaper mandolin and played that for about a year and liked it. And so then I bit the bullet and I ordered one with the same setup. So and this took quite a bit of experimenting, I'll say. So I use a Kent Armstrong humbucker, and he'll, you can like get him, you know, if you were send an email or something, you can get Kent on the phone and he'll make you a pickup. But it's a humbucker. He wound it mellow or to be suited for jazz. I don't know what that means, but I really love it. And I've tried other pickups. I've tried other people that make pickups for mandolins, and I found this for my taste and the thing I'm going for. It's worked the best. And it's mounted on just a normal A-style mandolin, but it's mounted at the end of the fingerboard, so it's floating. So the idea being that it's a nice acoustic mandolin on its own, you know, just a standalone normal mandolin, but it has this floating humbucker. And then I do have a tone, a volume and tone on it. And there is a piezo inside that I can split, but I don't use that. So
okay.
But it's there if I need it.
And you said you can call and get these pickups custom ordered. Is it four poles, like one for each course, or is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess it's eight poles since there's the doubles.
Up and down,
The thing for anyone that's, you know, interested in going down the same rabbit hole, you cannot buy a mandolin an electric mandolin that you can play a gig on. I don't think so. I think you can buy one that you could maybe record with and EQ it enough that it would work okay. But the stuff that people are selling is not, the string balance is going to be so off that you can't really work with it. So you've tried some single coils and some different humbuckers, but because like if you only have four, you have to have adjustable pole pieces, first of all. But the thing with the Kent Armstrong is since you have, you know, two rows and they're all adjustable, then you have like extra control over what's hotter and what's weaker. So like your G string is going to be super high, your A is going to be like kind of hot, and your E is going to be nothing with a just flat, you know, no adjustments. But you, in my opinion, I messed around with in like a Empress parametric EQ and all sorts of stuff to try to dial it in without adjustable pole pieces and using some of the options that are out there for, you know, that you can just order. And I didn't, for me, they didn't quite do it.
So. Right. We got a mandolin pickup hot take on the Fretboard Journal podcast. I love it. I mean, have you tried, you must have, you're probably exposed to all sorts of cool new and old instruments all the time, but have you tried like the old Fender? You just hated the four string Fender electric mandolins.
For me, I'm closed off. I don't know. I think I sold it. I had an eight, one of the Fender eights, and I swapped, and it had the stock pickup, and I didn't quite do it for me. So I bought you can buy a replacement, and it was better, but it still wasn't maybe the vibe I was going for. I think if you played in like a, you know, somewhere where you wanted higher gain or something, you know, if you played in like a Skynyrd cover band or something, I do think I think that might serve you well. What made a huge difference to me is I used before the Girard that I, you know, got Max to build. I mentioned I converted a cheaper mandolin with the same exact setup, and the quality of sound difference was huge between like a more affordable mandolin and like a more higher end mandolin with the same pickup. It was cool for me coming from an acoustic music background to hear that, yes, you know, a higher quality acoustic instrument will totally transfer, you know, for the sounds coming out of your amp. Like it makes a massive difference. So that was,
yeah, we didn't even get in. I mean, now we're in the weeds. What are you using to as an amp for an electrified mandolin?
I use a Quilter. It's like a Quilter Micro Pro. It's a pretty small amp. It's an 8-inch speaker, but it gets loud enough for all of my purposes. And I bought it because I basically wanted like a Fender kind of tweed sound, but if I dropped it, I wanted to, you know, have it hopefully be okay. So I went for kind of a bougier solid state.
It's okay. Yeah. You've got a lightweight setup compared to most musicians.
19 pounds.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've got the mandolin, is the pickup removable or?
Okay. It's some sort of epoxy. It's whatever. He said it's the same glue they use to hold wooden airplane propellers together.
Okay.
Sort of really, you know, strong epoxy glued on to there's a little tab on the pickup and it's glued to kind of the extension on the fingerboard.
Okay.
And I've had no issues in the couple of years I've been using it.
And let's talk about Chicken Bridge. Like, what was the idea behind it? We'll get into some tracks as well, but let's just hear the original idea.
So when I mentioned earlier, I started thinking a lot about like, what am I good at or what do I like and how can I do that with music? And I was writing a bunch of music at the time. And, I kind of wanted to, you know, at school and in Boston, there's a lot of really avant-garde stuff and a lot of more free music. And I kind of really wanted to do like a simple, like play a lot of more simple music, more blues based, blues oriented music. And I also thought to myself, like, what would my dream band be? You know, like, what would it consist of hypothetically? And I thought about Bass Desires, which is this band that existed briefly with Bill Frisell and Scofield. And I don't know, in a lot of ways, it's like my favorite band. And so I kind of really wanted like a quartet, like bass drums and electric guitar. And then I was back here in North Carolina and going to jams and stuff, playing with people. And I happened to meet this amazing guitar player. Cause when you get, I don't know, you know, there's so many people that are really good. So then at a certain point you forget about really good. Really good doesn't matter. It's almost like an assumption, or it doesn't matter because what is good, you know? And so then it's more like choices, you know, like who makes choices I like, and who has similar maybe goals, you know, musically. And so I met this guitar player that I heard him play at a jam. We didn't play together, and I got his number, and then we hung out, and it turns out his roommate's this drummer, and these guys have been like best friends since like first grade, you know, and they were roommates and they play together all the time. And so then we started playing some, and then they played with this bass player, Matt Laird, a lot, who's a great bass player. And I don't know, I think there was just some sort of, I guess, chemistry between us. And I think we just aligned on a lot of things. Like they were into jazz, but they also do a lot of different things and have a lot of other interests. Like they're into, you know, if they're into jazz, but they're not too into jazz, because jazz culture sometimes gets really like pretentious, or people want to like be vibey and mean to you because you like don't know a certain song or something, or you didn't end it how, you know, Coleman Hawkins did in 1939 or something, you know, which to me isn't what I love about the music, you know. So I met them, and I had been writing all this music, and they were down to rehearse and learn stuff. And it really just happened really quickly. We didn't even know each other that long before I was like, you know, kind of broke the news that I was thinking about doing an album and getting the money together and stuff. I don't know. I'm really proud of it. You know, I think a lot of times playing music and stuff, you do something and then you kind of don't like it, you know, like you do it, but then you're like, I wish this was better. And even, you know, now about a year after the release, I still feel really, I guess, proud of the album, and that I feel like I accomplished like what I was going for. I want to do more of it. You know, I have a bunch more stuff in the works.
Yeah. I mean, this is not an embarrassing debut album at all. I think, you know, the opening track, Sydney, is, which you kind of talked a little bit about, I want you to go a little deeper on that. Is so strong and so eye-opening to folks who, you know, think of the mandolin in a couple of different settings that it's most often heard in. Talk about that track. Talk about, you mentioned how you had one pedal board and one mandolin and then you put it down, but just let's walk through that track. How did you write it, and what did you actually use on it?
How did I write it? That's a good question. I don't know if there was some sort of, you know, big, great story behind writing it, but I wrote the song, and then I actually started dating this girl named Sydney. We're still dating too.
Okay, congrats.
And the melody, it like goes like, na 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 na, Sydney, da 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 da, Sydney. You know, like I feel like the melody really kind of stuck out to me in that way. And so it kind of came together in terms of naming the song and stuff with kind of, you know, maybe, you know, the something, you know, else important in my life aligned, yeah. Kind of maybe the refrain or whatever you want to call it in the melody of the song. And I think too, another thing is it's very D major. It's very kind of, I don't know, like it's not quite diatonic, but it's basically diatonic. And I think something that I have thought about a lot, and something that blew my mind is on Bill Frisell and Thomas Morgan on the Small Town album. They play Wildwood Flower, and that's a song that I've known since I, you know, like was a kid and stuff. And just hearing them play it, it's like the same song, and they clearly really value and respect the song, and they all know the melody, and it's really clear, but their interpretation of it is so different. And I think I just really like the idea of that you could take a song in a completely different kind of style and make it your own, you know, while still really respecting that original song and where it came from, you know. And so that, in a lot of ways, I really like this song Sydney because it's simple, you know, it's musically, harmonically, it's simple, but you know, you can do so much more besides, you know, jazz is all about chords or something and harmony, but I don't know, you know, it's not, there's so many different factors besides harmony, besides chords. There's articulation, there's dynamics, there's so many other things besides just chords and harmony. And so I really thought this song was a great way to have a lot of fun playing something that's fairly simple, but it's still accessible, and it's not, you know, just one chord or I don't know. I think it came together pretty well. And I really liked, you know, the looping stuff. I like to mess around with a looper, and a lot of it is clearly heavily influenced by Frisell as well. So it just, I don't know. I feel like it offered a really good platform for me to kind of do a lot of the things that I want to do and want to get better at.
Yeah. Well, are you using the same looper he is?
I don't. I do not use a DL4 because they're $300 and they break.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, that's a little out of my budget, you know. So
what are you using?
I'm using MXR. It's an MXR clone looper. Uh-huh. And I remember when they came out, I was so excited. I bought one like the day they came out because I'd been waiting for something where you could flip your loop into like reverse and half speed and double speed, all those things like live while you're playing.
Yeah.
Because some of the TC Electronic ones, like you can't, I think you can like choose one thing you want to do, like reverse or half speed or double. And so this one, you get the clone looper and then you get like a little MXR foot switch or tap tempo thing. And with that, you can live flip your loop around and delete it, you know, silent delete. And, just because I didn't want to get a DL4.
Yeah. Well, so there's more than that pedal on this track though, right?
There's, I use like a delay a little bit. I have an MXR carbon copy delay that's always on inaudibly.
Okay.
Or almost, you know, practically inaudibly. And then I have I think it's a Keeley reverb delay combo that just for some kind of ambient, you know, a little bit of reverb delay. Mm-hmm. And I'll use a chorus some too. My favorite thing, and I think this works with a lot of even slightly more traditional mandolin things, but you can, since mandolin has so much chorus already, you can kind of like bend the notes a little bit. And then when you flip your chorus on and it's like wide open, you almost don't even notice that. There's a couple of times in the album where I'll do that and you can get away with it. And it's super duper, I don't know if it's, I think the sound is different, but you can like make the transition into like in tune mandolin to core, you know, full blast chorus pedal, pretty almost seamlessly, which is pretty fun.
Yeah. Do these, this album's been out for about a year, like you've obviously played a lot of these tracks live. Do these tunes stretch out? Do you go wild?
Yeah. Live. I try to stretch out. Yeah. I like that's, you know, it's more fun to stretch out more and play more, play more where we might break the form open or play more where we might have a section that gets outside the form. Maybe we have some things planned, maybe we don't, but just the idea of having more flexibility. But and another thing too is to play stuff without form, you know, like maybe that makes it like free music, but then, you know, the connotation of free music is it, like, I feel like you think about like chaos or something, you know, often or but there's so many options, you know, you can break the form, but you still keep the tempo. Do you still keep a tone center, stuff like that? So I think there's ways to have a lot of fun and do things that might be a bit, you know, different while still, while still making accessible music. Cause I think that was a big goal with this album too, is I wanted, sometimes people cringe at the thought of jazz, or they think it's for like old people, or they don't like it or something. And for me, I was like, how can I make something that is clearly coming from, you know, jazz music, but is inviting? You know, I want people to think like, wow, this is good. I like this. This is fun.
Yeah.
Rather than it being some, you know, like deep intellectual thing, I guess, you know.
Yeah. I think you succeeded. I mean, are you now writing compositions that are a total departure from this? I mean, is the next project going to be on a completely different level, or what?
I think it'll be similar. I have a lot of this thing with this album is form wise, everything is fairly square, and that was kind of intentional because I was like, what can we like play at a gig? Like, let's say somebody blows off the rehearsals, doesn't really learn the music that well, which the guys on the album don't do. They're great. Amazing. Matt and Charlie, you should get them a gig. They're great. But hypothetically, like, how can I be successful? How can we go and play a set of all original music, and assuming everything behind the scenes goes wrong, how can it still be good? You know, that was like in a lot of ways what I was trying to do, because I've had that experience before where people, you know, don't necessarily learn what they said they were going to learn, you know. So I didn't want anything to be too crazy. But now that I have, now that Kurt and Matt and Charlie are just willing to learn my music, I want to take some liberties and extend, you know, like making the forms a little more complicated, or just not worrying about something like people actually learning the music or not, you know.
Yeah. Do you play out a lot? Do you do a lot of live shows?
Yeah, I play a lot. It's just random. I play a lot. Yeah, I play a lot. I play a lot of bluegrass stuff locally. We played at Shikori, this festival here last weekend, doing my music. And I played bluegrass stuff there too with some people. I want to do more. I want to do more. It's just, you send the email, send the email, send the email.
I mean, I don't know how many of these gigs have taken place, but I have to imagine at some point you're going to be up there with your pedal board playing your electrified mandolin, and some kid, as you were influenced by a mandolin player when you were a kid, like some kid's going to be geeking out going like, you can do that with that instrument? Like, sign me up.
You can do it. Yeah, you totally can. I think the mandolin can do a lot. I think a lot of like what people do with instruments is like based on like what you hear and where there's a platform for it, you know. For like, if I go to a jam, it's like it's something a little bit different. Like somebody's like, oh, a mandolin or something. It's not like the most, like, I think you have to put yourself out there a little bit more than just going and playing bluegrass or something. And I think in a lot of ways that's, and you can't, in my opinion, it's hard to go out and buy the setup that you need to get a just an instrument that's going to do what you need to do. So I think there's some blocks, but I think it's totally possible. I don't think it's that much different than anything. You just got to want it, you know, practice, work on it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want you getting burned at the stake or anything, but could you take that mandolin with the pickup epoxied in there and take it to a bluegrass jam and hold your own, or do you need to bring an acoustic only mandolin to like a traditional bluegrass jam?
Well, what's awesome is the mandolin, it's a really nice mandolin acoustically.
Yeah.
So I only ever play the one mandolin, and I play all sorts of different from, there's some super, super trad gigs and some more old and in the way kind of jammy stuff.
Yeah.
To, so I try to bring my amp, but if I know I'm going to, you know, somebody might give me a talking to, then I won't. But if you played mandolin much at gigs, you know, you'll never hear yourself. You never, ever hear yourself. So if you have an amp, you'll always hear yourself because you have your own like personal little monitor. So it's a nice DI too. So I usually just line out from the amp and set it on super low. Even at bluegrass stuff.
Wow. Yeah. Cool. We talked a little bit about the range of mandolins. I know a lot of folks, thanks to Sergio Rose and everything, are going to like octave mandolins and like larger bodied. Do you have thoughts about that? Or are you pretty happy with like, I got my one mandolin?
I'm pretty happy, but I do have an Eastwood, which is kind of this like funky company. And I spent a ton of money like redoing everything in it. I got the pickup rewound. I got new pots. So all the wiring's new. I got the fretboard redone with stainless frets and I put new tuners on it. Like I redid everything.
You've exceeded the value of the original instrument, probably.
Yes. And it's fun. I will say it's fun, but I...
What is it? Describe what the original concept of it was.
The original concept is an octave, or it might be a man. I know what it is. It's a mandola. They say it's a mandola, but if you look at like scale, if you get down into like the different scale lengths of a mandola and octave, it's at like the very top end of a mandola. And it's like at the very bottom end of an octave.
Okay.
But this guy, Jonathan Mann, makes an octave mandolin or like a five something with like a very similar scale length. So I got the string gauges that he uses for that. And I guess converted this mandola into an octave mandolin. So it's a super short scale octave. But after I redid everything, it's really quite nice.
Yeah. After thousands of dollars or $1,000 of repairs. What's life like for you right now in Chapel Hill? Are you teaching? Like, how are you filling your days?
How am I filling my days? I teach some. I taught a workshop last weekend. I was teaching guitar for a bit, and then I got a little burnt out on that. So I love teaching, but I want to teach. I think I want to teach mandolin or teach. I had so much fun. I was teaching these classes for a while through a place, and it was so much fun because it would be like an 8-week course, and I'd develop, you know, I would do like accompaniment for mandolin, you know, what to do besides doing a chop chord. And every week we'd go like chronologically through kind of the influential players, and I would do a transcription, and we'd cover like kind of like the different concepts that each player would use. And there'd be a transcription to prove it, that it wasn't just, you know, my opinion or whatever. So I love doing that, but, it was like so much work and it was not very much money. So right now I do like carpentry and stuff and play some gigs and yeah.
Yeah. Carpentry. I mean, it's slippery slope. You might find yourself building a mandolin, right?
The thing I always think about is like, I feel like building acoustic instruments, especially like arch back, you know, violin, mandolin, arch top. I feel like it's like the Ferrari of woodworking or something. It's like, I feel like it's so high level or something. So I've yet to dive into it. But I bet I've talked to some people and they said, like it's mostly like a time thing, you know, like you just gotta, and I guess the same as anything, you know, like you spend enough time doing something. I'd like to make like chairs or something.
A little more practical, a little easier out of the gate.
Easier out of the gate might be questionable, man. You like read some books and it,
chairs. You're talking about fancy. Yeah, I got it. Yeah.
These chairs are like hard, man. It's harder. I made one.
You're kind of in chair country though, right? Like Brian Boggs and all that. That's all near you, right?
There's a huge, like, hand tool woodworking scene around here. I didn't know it at all until the last few years. I've been, you know, hobby making stuff. I will say hand tool woodworking and carpentry are, at least carpentry in the, you know, 21st century are like a different, they're almost a different thing.
Sure.
It's, but yeah, it's fun. I, you know, I love doing that. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Same as, it's the same as music where you gotta, it's like, to, you know, like trying to make money and stuff. And like, it's a very similar industry. I feel like, where we're, you know, like crafting your name, you know, your name and your audience, and how teaching is like a huge income source for a lot of people. It's been, interesting to see.
Yeah, I bet. So amongst the things I noticed about Chicken Bridge is you have a great quote from Julian Lage. How did you and he cross paths, and have you played together?
We've played, well, I took lessons with him. Took lessons with him. So we played together in a lesson, you know. but that was really great. And I'm really glad he let me, you know, put a quote on my site. Because he if you haven't met him, especially if you meet, I feel like through going to New England Conservatory, I got to take lessons with a lot of really incredible people. And it's like interesting to interact with different people that are really famous and successful and kind of see like how good they are, like at teaching, or are they like, are they actually paying attention? Do they actually, you know what I mean? And Julian is like so authentic. Like every time, like I feel like if you met him on the street or something, you would have like the most authentic, nice interaction with him. He just is I feel like a kind person. It's really amazing, to see. I feel like there's, you know, he's not like pretentious, or he's not gonna, you know, say something snarky or rude or something, but you know, like I feel like he's really good at seeing where you're at and giving feedback. And for me, I thought it was really great. Just, he's such a good guitar player, and then he's such a good teacher, and he has a lot of insights just on, I don't know, just like anybody who plays at such a high level, I feel like they're going to pick up on just so many things so quickly. It's cool. Ethan Iverson is another person where he's just like, you play for like 3 seconds and he has such a, like, he can talk to you for like 2 hours about like what you should do to make your eighth notes better or something, you know, like this microscopic little thing you can like hone in on. Julian's not like a microscope, but he's really good like with concept and like just so much, I don't know. He just, for me, it was so good because he's just so nice and so genuine. And I feel like I really needed that, you know. And I'm just really, super thankful to have had the opportunity.
When you did that, I mean, I think it's, this happens in jazz and probably in classical music too, but not outside of those genres much, where you're taking lessons from someone who's not even playing the instrument that's your main instrument. Did you go to Julian with specific questions of like, what do you think about when I do this? Or did you just play for him and have him riff, or like, how did that unfold?
I guess it was, there was no talk about like fingerings or pick direction. But I'll say I don't really think about like stuff like fingerings or pick direction or like positions and shifting. So it was mostly like I play for him, or I might bring in some songs or compositions, whatever you want to call it. And we could go through like arrangement, like perform. A lot of it was performance based, you know, like directly, like, you know, like playing a concert, you know, like, what would your program be? What would that look like? How can you be, I don't know, better, you know, like show up? How can you, you know, stuff like, there's a huge thing. It's, I think you take, you know, people think about technique a lot, you know, in the same way that people think about notes a lot, but there's like all these other factors, like your program or something, you know, or the song choice, or like how you structure your arrangement. I guess that's, you know, that's, it's not that deep or anything, but all these things matter. And I think it's easy, at least for me, to get bogged down. And you think about like one factor, but there's like 10, and they're all equally as important. So I think studying with Julian, he really just helped me devote more of my attention to something like articulation or something, you know, rather than just technique. And I don't know, you hear a lot of bands and they don't have that many, like there's not that much dynamic contrast, you know?
Sure.
And I feel like that's like a, you start tuning into these things like articulation and dynamics. And I feel like it's almost like a, like an easy, like a easy way to just be a lot better, you know?
Like yeah. It's not like, that's it's crazy to think, but brilliant to like talk to a master about like what would make for the strongest set list, even like
totally. Or somebody I saw some, it might have just been on Instagram, but somebody like was like, what, like with rock guitar or something, like there's so many guys that are incredible, like technically can play everything, you know, but then like the people that are famous, he was saying, there's this guy, Daniel Donato. He's kind of a famous guy. He was saying that you listen to BB King or John Mayer or whoever your favorite person is, and they often just have like this great sense of dynamics and articulation and touch. And that's what makes them who they are, rather than just Jim who plays at whatever jam every Tuesday. Because in a lot of ways on paper, they have all the same technique. They have all the same abilities. But it's these little things that make it so much better. So I don't know. I think about that a whole lot, the dynamic contrast and range.
Yeah. Well, are you going to start recording again soon, or what's next?
I would like to. I don't have a date, but I have a big list of songs that we need to rehearse and workshop and I'm really excited about doing that. Yeah. Cause I want to get on it. Cause you know, like I have these guys I really love playing with, but you know, how long until somebody moves somewhere else or something changes, you know? So
life I takes really, over. Yeah.
Yeah. So we need to get going on it before, so I don't have to find another drummer or something. Cause I really love all the guys on that album, playing with them so much. In Boston, there's like a million people that are so good, you know, and then I feel like I moved back here and I just like feel like I randomly met this group of people that I like love making music with. So it's kind of just a really nice experience.
That's awesome. Well, Simon, thank you. It was great chatting with you. Finally, we've been talking about this for a little while.
I really appreciate this, Jason. I've been a band for a long time. When I was a kid, I had the Froggy Bottom guitar, the edition, and what, there was a Sam Bush, Tim O'Brien one.
Yep.
When I was like maybe 12 or something, for Christmas, I got the, you know, Fretboard Journal.
Oh man, you're making me feel old now.
No, but I love what you're doing. I really, it's cool. You know, there's not a million people that make something that's so interesting and relevant and exciting, like for someone like me. So
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Well, I love the record. I hope people go check it out. That song, that track Sydney, is incredible. Your girlfriend should be very happy.
thanks.
And thanks for talking to me.
Yeah. Thanks, Jason.
All right, that was my conversation with Simon Dunson. If you've made it this far and you're into mandolins, I might as well let the cat out of the bag. We got Sam Bush coming on the podcast in just a few weeks as well, and a whole bunch of other great performers and builders. I can't wait to share them all with you. Stay tuned till next Friday. If you like the podcast, as always, share it with your friends. And if you really want to help me out, leave a review over on Apple Podcasts. It helps others find the show.